In his new book, The Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606, James Shapiro offers a portrait of one of the most inspired moments in William Shakespeare's career, the extraordinary year in which he completed King Lear and then went on to write two other great tragedies, Macbeth and Antony and Cleopatra. Shapiro, a preeminent Shakespeare scholar and author of the previous books A Year in the Life of William Shakespeare, 1599, and Contested Will, sheds new light on these plays by placing them within the context of their times. James Shapiro is the Larry Miller Professor of English at Columbia University. He is a governor of the Folger Shakespeare Library, a member of the board of directors of the Royal Shakespeare Company, Shakespeare scholar in residence at New York's Public Theater, and was recently inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. It's a great pleasure to welcome James Shapiro back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be speaking with you.
Thank you very much. What brought you to this particular subject and this particular year?
I had spent 15 years writing a book about the year 1599, and that came out a decade ago. And when I finished it, I realized I knew a lot about Shakespeare as an Elizabethan writer, but I knew almost nothing about what he was up to in the last decade of his career after Queen Elizabeth had died, and he became the king's man, a player under King James. So I thought I'd make reparations, I'd go back to the archives, and I'd try to understand what I did not really fully comprehend, which is how Shakespeare was responding to the extraordinary events that were taking place as he was writing plays like Macbeth and King Lear.
The point you make in the book is that it was a very creative year for Shakespeare personally, a terrible year for the country, for England, and as you explore in the book, the two are connected.
It was a great year for Shakespeare, and it was a terrible year, as you say, for England. Political divisions, religious divisions, plague returning with a vengeance, and a sense of darkness, really, and grimness in the aftermath of a failed terrorist attack, the gunpowder plot, in the last few weeks of 1605. And the first 6 months of 1606 were spent rounding up, torturing, trying and executing the surviving plotters. So it was a year in which Shakespeare's England was struggling for answers, and there were no newspapers at the time. There weren't competing forms of media, no radio or anything like that. Plays were the places where people worked out these issues, and Shakespeare really rose to the occasion in writing plays that we look at as written for all time, but were written for an extraordinarily fraught moment.
You point out in the book that when you look at Shakespeare's life and you look at biographies of Shakespeare, that by the time you get to the year of 1603, there really aren't that many pages written beyond that.
I'm as guilty as anyone, having written so many books about the early Shakespeare, about how Shakespeare becomes Shakespeare. But it's as equally a pressing question when you're dealing with such extraordinary works like Antony, Cleopatra, Lear, and Macbeth, all of which he wrote in this year. The question of how does Shakespeare as an accomplished playwright find his footing in a new regime and speak to his moment? And it could not have been easy. Shakespeare was not as prolific one year to the next as we might imagine. He had, like every writer, fallow periods and wrote plays and inspired bunches as well. So I became interested in the inspired bunch of plays he wrote at this moment and what was going on that might have inspired him to do so.
When you look at those inspirations, it's interesting to note of how important collaboration became.
Shakespeare was always a collaborative writer. At the beginning of his career, in plays like Titus Andronicus and Henry VI Part I, he was working with more established playwrights. In the middle and towards the very end of his career, he was reaching out to young men who were 15 years younger, playwrights who were writing edgier drama. He didn't want to write the same play again and again, and he certainly wanted to speak with the same urgency as the most popular writers of his day were. So Shakespeare wrote collaboratively. He obviously had to perform collaboratively since he's writing plays for a group of actors with whom he'd been working for over a decade at this point. So one of the challenges for me is to figure out the ways in which he is part of a larger group of artists creating something extraordinary.
You mentioned the Gunpowder Plot and the impact that had. Talk a little bit about why that was such an important historical event and why it so informed Shakespeare and his work in that year.
Nothing happened on November 15th. There was no explosion that eliminated the political leadership and the religious leadership of England as the plotters had desired and restored Catholicism, nor had 30,000 Londoners been blown up when those 36 barrels of gunpowder placed under Parliament were almost set off. So disaster was averted. But England had never dealt with what we would call a terrorist attack of this scale and enormity. And after the plot failed, the surviving plotters raced to Shakespeare country and tried to foment an uprising to overthrow the government and restore Catholicism. Shakespeare knew people on both sides of this personally, and he was at the epicenter of both places where this uprising and planned attack occurred. He understood the questions that were circulating in the same way that we, after 9/11, ask questions which we have never really asked with such urgency before. Where does such evil come from? Is it about religious difference? Does it come from inside of individuals, or does it come from an ideology that has been imposed on them? In much the same way, plays like Macbeth struggle to understand an attempt to kill a Scottish king, an attempt by people who are informed or misled in certain ways, or does that evil come from Macbeth and Lady Macbeth? So that the issues that are in the air at this time begin to percolate and begin to shape not just Shakespeare's plays, but plays by contemporaries like Ben Jonson, performed by Shakespeare's company at this time.
When you study and examine the plays of this time, what does it do to help fill in the blanks of the surviving history of what we know to have taken place?
History is a funny thing. It's almost always written by the winners, as the cliche goes, no more so than in this year. But the government didn't really understand how to turn the Gunpowder Plot into a story. Do you exploit a crisis, as we now think of? Every crisis should always be exploited today. It's a political axiom. Shakespeare's plays allow us to feel the anxieties and concerns and preoccupations of his day in a way that official history versions do not, so that they illuminate the received histories and question them. In the same way, our understanding of history, and I try to flesh out what we know historically, illuminates these plays. And I think if you hold the plays up to their times, they become richer and more exciting documents.
James Shapiro is our guest. The name of the book is The Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606. When you look at King Lear, so let us look at that particular tragedy. And in studying this, did you see it in a new way after looking at it through this particular microscope?
I did, and I think contemporaries would have seen the story of King Lear in a different way after seeing Shakespeare's version. We're not taught this in high school or college when we study the play, but for a decade or so before Shakespeare wrote his play, there was a play called King Lear that theatergoers in London could see all the time. And it was a play that ended happily with King Lear restored to his throne and reconciled with his youngest daughter named Cordelia. Shakespeare took this old Elizabethan story and turned it into the darkest of Jacobean tragedies. If you and I were playgoers going to the theater in 1606 thinking, let's go see the story of Lear. We love that story. We love the happy, warm-hearted ending. And we watched Shakespeare's version of this play in which everyone in the royal family is killed. The kingdom is reduced to its knees. It's almost like Beckett in its darkness. I think we would have been shocked. And I think that the darkness of the times informs the darkness of that play.
Did you have trouble, and we talked about why this period is not written about much and is often glossed over. Is that because there's difficulty in finding surviving history and source and scholarship? Did you find it difficult? Was that a challenge in writing about this particular time?
It's always hard finding out about a world we have lost from 400 years ago. What was the weather like? How many plague deaths? There is evidence, and it has to be slowly woven together. But it's a given that everybody loves the Tudors. We love Wolfe Hall. We love Henry VIII. We love the story of the Virgin Queen Elizabeth. No one really likes King James. He was too smart for his own good. He was profligate. His is not a realm that generates any kind of excitement in movies and TVs and books and adaptations, even for historians today. And that's a shame because Shakespeare wrote his greatest plays during the reign of King James. The King James Bible, which is so central to our culture, was created at this time. And November the 5th, the gunpowder plot, Guy Fawkes Day, was the seminal historical event, an attack, terrorist attack from those times. So there's a lot of stuff that survives, but it hasn't really interested historians or novelists or those who try to retell the past.
Let's talk a little bit about King James. And you write about this, of how he was fascinated by the supernatural and the occult, and deeply interested in witchcraft. How did that ultimately find its way into Shakespeare's work?
Well, we all know the three witches in Macbeth that lure him to his equivocal destruction. King James and everyone else in England is interested in the supernatural. Does the devil tempt us? Are we susceptible to the devil's temptation? Are we possessed? And I tell a wonderful story about a young woman named Anne Bellamy who faked demonic possession. And she and her father cooked up this to attract attention and deceive neighbors. And they used as a textbook a book by a man named Harsnett that Shakespeare himself was reading and drawing upon in creating a role for a man who's possessed, Edgar, in King Lear. So there are a lot of moments in the story that I'm telling where life borrows from art and art borrows from life, nowhere more so than when dealing with supernatural. At the very end of my research, when the book was already being typeset, I stopped the presses because I got a phone call from archaeologists in England who had discovered during the very months that Shakespeare was writing Macbeth, carpenters at Knowle, about 20 miles south of London, were putting a oak beam into a room being prepared for a royal visit that had all these markings on it to keep the devil and demonic forces away. So this is something that saturated the culture and was a preoccupation, not just for King James, but for Shakespeare and the thousands who went to see a play like Macbeth.
James Shapiro is our guest. The name of the book is The Year of Lear. You also talk about specific words and how his use of words helped in the evolution of their definition. I'm hoping you can talk about a few of them, beginning with the word assassination.
No one had ever used the word assassination in a poem or pamphlet before Shakespeare had. it's a word familiar to us today, sadly, in the wake of JFK's assassination or Martin Luther King. It is a word that must have stunned audiences hearing Macbeth talk about if the assassination of King Duncan were accomplished. And it's a word that would never be used by Shakespeare again. But in this year, we have an assassination attempt on King James, not only with a gunpowder plot, but a feared assassination attempt that almost roiled the whole country in March of that year. So I try to be as sensitive as I can to big words like assassination as I am to small words like nothing, which occurs again and again and again in King Lear, or to the word equivocation, which in Hamlet, Shakespeare had used in a kind of neutral sense as meaning ambiguous. Does a word mean one thing or does it mean something else? But by the time Shakespeare is writing Macbeth, a play steeped in equivocation, where Macbeth talks about the equivocation of the fiend, where the porter who comes in drunkenly talks again and again about equivocating, Shakespeare is dealing with the hottest word of his day. Because in the aftermath of the gunpowder plot, a how-to manual was discovered in the lodgings of one of the plotters on how to equivocate, how to deceive the authorities by saying one thing and thinking something else. And this, to Jacobean legal and political authorities, was terrifying. It would destabilize all kinds of social relations and political relations. No one could be trusted. Shakespeare takes this word and infuses Macbeth not just with that term, but what it means to live in a world where people, even well-intentioned people, think one thing and must say another because of the times and suspicious worlds that they find themselves in.
You even spend time in the book discussing his use of British and Britain compared to English and England. Why is that particular distinction significant?
Shakespeare was really lucky as a playwright to have started his career in the waning years of Queen Elizabeth's life, when everyone knew the Queen was too old to marry, too old to have children, but had not named a successor. So the first decade of his playwriting career is obsessed with Englishness, with the possibility of civil war, of regime change, and the threats that had unsettled England in the 15th century when there were struggles for succession to the English throne. So the Elizabethan Shakespeare is one who again and again is obsessed with Englishness and English identity, right up to a play like Henry V, which celebrates that. But when Elizabeth died and was succeeded by King James, who came down from Scotland, he was King James VI of Scotland and now King James I of England, he came to England with two sons and a daughter and a wife, and succession was off the table. But he also came to England with a plan to unite England and Scotland into Great Britain. Now, we're watching the unraveling of that right now politically as England and Scotland struggle to redefine their own relationship right now in a Great Britain. But King James wanted to unite everybody, and he was keen on it. He felt to be king of two kingdoms and married to two kingdoms made him a bigamist. It had to be one. And what he did was create in England an identity crisis where there had been none before. Were people English? What did it mean to be British? And the pushback to this led a playwright like Shakespeare to start writing about Britishness rather than Englishness. The term Britishness and Britain occur for the first time in King Lear. They are central to a play like Macbeth. Shakespeare was as good as anybody at exploiting an identity crisis, and the king created one through which he would then create great drama.
You write about the year of Lear, Shakespeare, in 1606. 10 years later, Shakespeare died, and we will be marking the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death next year. As I mentioned in the introduction, you serve on the board of the Folger Shakespeare Library. So how will this be celebrated?
One of the brilliant things that the Folger Shakespeare Library is doing is sending first folios of Shakespeare's work, a book in which the first surviving copy of Antony and Cleopatra and Macbeth come down to us. They're sending these folios to all 50 states, and individuals everywhere will be able to participate locally in what are really a national Shakespeare celebration. Americans have long had a special relationship to Shakespeare's works, and this is going to be really an extraordinary year to reflect 400 years after his death on how he continues to shape our political thinking, our notions of our own identities, how we think of everything from the family and marriage to regime change.
The name of the new book is The Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606. It is published by Simon & Schuster. James Shapiro, a great pleasure to have you back on the program. Thank you very much for spending time with us.
It's a pleasure talking, and I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is The Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606. It's published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.